When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window. This is the podcast that not only takes you inside the biggest deals at the biggest clubs in world football, but brings you insight and analysis on the issues that matter every Monday, Wednesday and Friday. I'm Johnny McFarlane, and joining me are pundits extraordinaire Duncan Castles and Ian McGarry. On today's Transfer Podcast, Duncan Castles takes us inside his scoop that seven Manchester United players are now considering their futures at the club. We bring you an update on Manchester City's pursuit of a defensive midfielder as a long-term replacement for Fernandinho. And we look at the lack of competition in the top five leagues and ask if a European Super League is now inevitable. Okay, well, we're going to start with a story that was broken yesterday by Mr. Duncan Castles of this parish in the Sunday Times regarding seven Manchester United players who are now considering their future for next season. And it's some big names too, no fringe players in there. This is the players that you would expect to be perhaps hanging around at Manchester United under a new boss with so much potential to turn the club around. Duncan, what does this mean for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Ed Woodward and the project at Manchester United over the coming years?
Well, look, we've had a lot of discussion in the last few weeks about Manchester United's strategy going into next season and the acceptance that they have to make significant changes to the squad. There has been briefing from the club that Ed Woodward and the Glazers want to invest heavily in Solskjaer. And in his squad and his ideas for the team. The idea has been floated that it could be a record spend in a transfer window for Manchester United, over £200 million potentially on transfer fees alone. And the sense has been, look, we're going to fix the problems. We're going to give them a squad that's capable of competing for the title and competing for the Champions League. And it's been very much about moving out some players that they don't want anymore and then buying young, exciting talents who they think can turn into the top players in English and European football down the line. This is kind of the other side of what's happening at Manchester United, is what I reported in the Sunday Times. It's talking about, calling the sullen seven. And it's the sense that they've actually got to look to hold on to players who are key operatives in their squad, as well as bringing new players to supplement them. And just going through key figures and totalling up the number of key figures in that squad who are considering whether now is the time to leave Manchester United and looking at options elsewhere. And I think also affected by the idea that Manchester United might not be in Champions League next season. They have that battle to finish in the top four or have to win the Champions League to get their place there. And it's quite an incredible list. There's Paul Pogba, obviously, who has stated his interest in moving to Real Madrid and who Real Madrid's manager said he would like to have at the club. So there you've got the most expensive signing in Manchester United's history. Juan Mata, who's out of contract and in contract discussions with Barcelona, amongst others, who was at one point Manchester United's record signing. You've got their best player, best goalkeeper in the Premier League for five of the last 6 years, David De Gea. You've got their most expensive defender, Eric Bailly, who's unhappy with his status in the squad and considering options elsewhere and has attracted interest from significant clubs such as Tottenham and Arsenal. You've got their best paid player Alexis Sanchez, and this is probably the only one of the seven that United would definitely like to leave if they could find someone to take his wages on. And then you've got their most expensive forward, Romelu Lukaku, who has been unhappy for some time about his status in the team and the fact that he lost his place as starting centre-forward to Marcus Rashford. Doesn't have any problems with Solskjaer, but has been, from that point on, has been thinking, if I am not going to be a guaranteed starter in this team next season, because the manager prefers to play other players in these positions, then I need to look at my options elsewhere. And his new agent gave an interview on Friday expressing basically that, saying that they'll assess their future at the end of the season and making it very pointedly clear that Serie A was an option for Lukaku. And then finally you have Ander Herrera, who, as we broke on the podcast last week, has already agreed a pre-contract with Paris Saint-Germain and will be going. And while he doesn't qualify in any of those sort of record signing categories or highest paid player, he has recently been described by Solskjaer as vital to his team. So it's quite a list. And, you know, it underlines that there's a lot more to do about improving this squad than just bringing new players in. They have to secure their top players before, or at least at the same time as they bring new players in, and makes the squad planning much harder than it would seem, I think, from the outside. And I think apparently than it would seem from the inside, because I don't think Manchester United have been aware of just the scale of the problem they have in terms of uncertainty about whether Manchester United is the right place to further sporting careers amongst key players who are already at the team.
I think this has more than a slight whiff of the morning after the night before about it. The natural enthusiasm and almost giddiness which enveloped Manchester United as a football club, and certainly the dressing room, in the first few weeks of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's interim reign, has all but evaporated. And in that time, we saw almost every single player give interviews about, we want Ole to get a job because he's great and he's brilliant and we all love him. And since then, 3 defeats in 4 games has brought reality very much back home to Manchester United about how much work there does have to be done in terms of restructuring the squad. It's a squad which has proven itself to not be capable to compete for the Premier League title. They've got a very, very difficult task in overcoming Barcelona in Champions League quarter-final over the next 2 weeks. And they've got a huge amount of work on, and it's about strategy now more than anything, because there are players in that sullen seven that Duncan has listed who they probably could either afford or cannot avoid losing, i.e. Herrera, Mata, who are out of contract, who make their own decisions. Bai, who has been very inconsistent. Sanchez, who we know is just a bad smell in the dressing room. Lukaku has, again, failed to really reproduce the kind of goal-scoring form at a consistent level for Manchester United that he has done at Everton, and even maybe even more impressively in loan moves when he was at Chelsea. So for Solskjaer, Ed Woodward, and a potential new director of football who it's been stated they want to have in place for the start of next season, their biggest problems are obviously trying to convince De Gea and Pogba to stay. That's the priority. And other than that, is looking at the other 5, as Duncan said, trying to move Sanchez out because he's the one that unanimously needs to go. With regards to the other ones, well, shopping for football players isn't quite as straightforward or easy as some people might think it is. Not only is it extremely expensive with regards to transfer fee, agent's fee, and then obviously the contract itself, but it's convincing players that they're coming to a club that has ambition, that can fulfil their personal ambition in the team environment and ultimately bring them sporting success. Now, that's not something Manchester United can guarantee anyone right now. And I suspect what they need, and this, you know, would be, if you like, Solskjaer's dream scenario, is some kind of catalysing incident or signing which convinces the other players at the club to stay, as well as other players who are considering joining and they're considering signing to come. Now, that could be progress beyond Barcelona in the Champions League and possibly even into the final and beyond, who knows? Or it could be that if United are shrewd, which they haven't been, we have to, you know, say that in the transfer market, but if they are shrewd and they are strategic, they have already got a big, you know, I won't say star name, but a very significant signing in the pipeline, ready to unveil at the end of the season and make a statement, therefore, saying, this is why you want to come play for Manchester United, because you will be playing in a team with ambition, you will be playing in a team which has a chance of winning titles, etc., etc. And that's your dream kind of scenario with regards to how you turn a club's fortunes around in terms of making them relevant again. However, flip side of that is, lose Mata Herrera, potentially lose De Gea, which looks likely, potentially lose Pogba, or at least get yourself involved in a prolonged transfer wrangle with Real Madrid, which United fans have been frustrated with before with regards to Cristiano Ronaldo's move, which was delayed a year until after the 2008 European Cup success. He then moved in 2009 to Real Madrid after Fergie famously said, I wouldn't sell that club a virus. I think these are contesting times for Manchester United with regards to what they do, because just look up above them. They've got Liverpool and Manchester City in far superior shape with regards to depth of squad, first 11, ability to compete on all fronts as well, as Manchester City continue to show, despite Pep's protestations that a quadruple is impossible. And that's their noisy neighbours. So this is a major, major problem. And one probably, that Solskjaer had at least thought about, but certainly one that they shouldn't be in. They shouldn't be in this state. There should be more strategic thinking ahead of this. They shouldn't be in contract negotiations at the 13th hour, 11th hour, I should say, with Mata and Herrera. Those decisions should be made long ago. And even Pogba, who's 2 years out of contract this summer. So, yeah, big, big summer for United and for Woodward and whoever the director of football is going to be.
Just say on Lukaku, in terms of his scoring, he was the highest scorer for Manchester United last season, and he is the leading scorer again for them this season. And his goal per minute ratio is better than any of the other forwards in the team. It's a goal every 170 minutes. And better than anyone apart from, interestingly enough, Marouane Fellaini, who has already gone. It hasn't been a good season for Lukaku. He struggled at the start of it. There were a number of reasons for that.
I don't think, even though they're mates, I doubt very much that Lukaku will be boasting that he's ahead of Fellaini on goals per minute ratio.
No. But look, the point on Lukaku is he still delivered the goals despite not being first choice under Solskjaer, despite struggling after the World Cup with fitness and weight. And I think there were some personal issues in the background that affected his focus in the early part of the season. So he would be a difficult. You'd have to be very clever, a very certain. That you don't want that player anymore as part of your squad before you let him go to Serie A in the summer, because you've decided that Marcus Rashford, whose shots on target ratio still stands at slightly over 50%, despite having been moved to that centre-forward position, is the man who's going to lead your attack and help you win a Premier League title.
Well, you say that about Lukaku, Duncan, but interestingly, you know, negotiations with Marcus Rashford's representatives have been ongoing as well with regards to tying him down on a new long-term contract. So it's a bit of a state, really, when you think that Lukaku's considering his future. Rashford clearly hasn't yet been satisfied with either the offer he's been made or indeed what is in prospects for Manchester United in the next 1, 2, 3 years in which he'd be signing up for. That's a real, real problem, because goals, as we know, are the hardest to buy in elite level football. And at the moment, you know, United need goals. They haven't had enough this season, clearly. Otherwise, they've been in a much better position, challenging. So, yeah, Rashford's situation also needs to be addressed.
Okay, well, we always like to deliver news on the Transfer Window podcast. We've got a pretty good ratio for doing so. And Duncan, I hear you have some about Manchester City for next season.
Yeah, it's more of an update of where Manchester City are in terms of filling their key recruitment priority for the summer window, which is a midfielder capable of taking on the Fernandinho role, capable of sharing duties with the Brazilian next season, and also playing elsewhere in the midfield, giving Guardiola a second option in that key position in front of the defence. They feel they're quite far advanced in securing the player. One of the major candidates is Rodri at Atletico Madrid. The advantage of Spain international is that he has a defined buyout clause, which is accessible for Manchester City. He's interested in coming. They rate him highly. Guardiola likes him a lot, and he looks at present to be a better bet than, for example, Ruben Neves, who's another player in that position that they've pursued for a long time. They know Neves can do it in the Premier League, but the problem with Neves is that Wolves are in no need of money and value him at over 100 million. And that is significantly more than they would have to pay to get Rodri from Atletico. Rodri's an interesting one because he is one of a number of holding midfielders that Jose Mourinho recommended to Manchester United signing. And he tried to push him on their transfer list actually just before Atletico came in and signed him. But basically, I think Atletico became aware that United were interested in the player and moved quickly to get a deal done while he was still cheap and available, and he's been a huge success for them. So that's where Manchester City are in that area of the team, and I think there's a reasonable chance we'll see that signing being completed before the end of the summer.
I think it's very likely, Duncan, having spoken to sources at Manchester City. I'm told there have been several conversations with the player's representatives. The player has indicated his desire to go to Manchester City. He sees that as an exciting project for him. He's only 22, 23 this summer. Very impressively made a mark on Atletico Madrid this season, playing 40 matches in all, notably 27 in La Liga and 8 in the Champions League. His role and his discipline is something which is key. he doesn't, for a young man, get overexcited and go out of position. He almost thrives in his role as a player who breaks up offensive play in either the middle third or indeed his own final third of the pitch. And I think City are very keen on for the reason that he shows that tactical discipline already for a young man. Also very impressive physically, as Fernandinho is, but mobile. And also he has that top-level experience. I'd say 27 La Liga appearances, 8 in the Champions League. You can't imagine him not coming and hitting the ground running at City and therefore being able to be a very effective player for them. And also just look at the players that he's competing against. I mean, Thomas Partey is one of my favourite players of last season in the Atletico Madrid midfield, albeit he can be a bit more offensive. But, Rodri, for players come in, has done exceptionally well. And I think as well, City are going to be advantaged by the fact that there's a little bit of discord at Atletico now. I think there's some feeling, both at the club and possibly, certainly in the press, that the Simeone era is getting towards a point where maybe it's just gone on a bit too long. And for Rodri, getting out of that before things start to dilapidate or indeed break up further would be a good move.
Yeah, he's just 22 years old. They completed the deal with Villarreal last summer for around 20 million initial fee, so they make a big profit on it. But I think one of the key things is his height. You know, he's 1 meter 91. We know that Manchester City are short on players of stature, and it's something that Guardiola likes to have one or two extra in there to compensate for having to play so many smaller players, mobile players in his attack. And it's going to strengthen him even further. I think what was quite impressive for me in the way that City played Brighton in the FA Cup semi-final was just how strong they were in central defence in terms of clearing away set pieces, which is Brighton's main attacking threat. Emerick Laporte and Otamendi, very influential in that game in terms of stopping Brighton from having good chances from set pieces. And if they're able to add another standard player, so Rodri would be, you'd expect to start a lot of their games next season in that height range, that's only going to strengthen them in the Premier League.
Well, in Europe's top five leagues, the big clubs in each one lead the way, and significantly with the exception of England. Of course, in the Premier League, Liverpool and Manchester City are duking it out for top spot with very little between them. But in France, PSG are storming away with the league. In Italy, Juventus, in Spain, Barcelona, and in Germany, Bayern Munich have come back after Dortmund took an early lead in the league and are now storming clear. They just won 4-0 at the weekend. Ian, are we in a situation now where this polarisation between the truly big clubs and the rest in every league is becoming more and more stark in a way that continues to underline the case for further revamping of the Champions League and potentially a European Super League in the future?
First of all, Johnny, I've got to congratulate you on a Dr. Duncan Castle's intro question, as long as a quick fire round.
Got there in the end.
Exactly, you did indeed. But yeah, you make a very good point. There seems to be a cyclical nature in the top five leagues in Europe, whereby a club dominates and then you get a real title race maybe one or two years in a row because of maybe freak of nature or decent investment, etc., etc. But at this weekend, both Juventus and PSG could have won the league in early April. In fact, Juventus missed that opportunity to be the quickest ever Scudetto when they drew at the weekend and are now 20 points clear of Napoli. Paris Saint-Germain, never in doubt. They seem to do this every season anyway. And then Barcelona, I think, it's significant in their late 2-0 victory against Atletico, effectively sealing their title. And now the advantage, of course, if you want to call it that gives certainly Juventus and Barcelona, is that they go into quarterfinals, not semis, quarterfinals in the Champions League, knowing that they can actually rest players for in league games because the title's effectively tied up. And that gives them an advantage against other clubs like Tottenham, Manchester City and Liverpool, who, of course, are all competing either for the league title or indeed the right to be Champions League contenders and be in the competition next season. So they're still trying to juggle the high pressure of playing Premier League matches, every one of which is effectively a must-win game, with Champions League matches which take a lot out of your team and your squad, both physically and mentally, because of the nature of winning that competition, or the possibility of getting to the semi-finals, final, etc., etc. So there is there's definitely a polarisation with regards to what the competition is like. I said Italy and France are the two most obvious in terms of lack of competition. Bayern Munich have created a Lazarus-like resurrection against Dortmund, who were 9 points clear at one point in the Bundesliga. But as you said, Johnny came back and gave them a good thumping at the weekend. So what this has in terms of knock-on effect, lots of conversations between UEFA and the European Club Association 2 weeks ago with regards to revamping the Champions League. The initial proposal was to move Champions League games to weekends and therefore return domestic league matches to midweek. But they want to stave off the possibility of the big clubs going rogue and starting their own effectively European Super League. The way things are just now with Juventus and PSG, you'd have to say that such a league would be much more attractive to them and their fans because they clearly aren't getting the kind of competition to challenge them in their domestic leagues as they currently are, would like, or I guess maybe not like, as they would get if they were in a European Super League. So there are consequences for this. But at the same time, we have seen this kind of trend before. And what the reaction to it from UEFA has always been to try and broker a deal which makes the big clubs easier to progress to the latter stages of the Champions League, therefore get more financial reward for doing so, and therefore hold the whole sort of competitive nature of the central competition together. But with football finance changing the way it has, especially when you have nation-state ownership of clubs like PSG and Manchester City by Middle Eastern principalities, then I think, Duncan, we are going to have be asking different questions in the coming sort of years and months with regards to where this leaves us.
I think it's kind of been a self-destructive process, in the sense that there's always been pressure from the top clubs in Europe to get as much money out of their domestic leagues and out of European competition as possible. And there's been a tension between a loose confederation of the biggest clubs in Europe and UEFA to extract more cash from the Champions League for those top clubs to secure the qualification. And we've seen things like it being more guaranteed places being given to the big leagues consistently down the years, but also more television money being given to the top teams consistently. Most recent change has been to vary the payments for Champions League appearances in a given season according to the club's track record in past seasons, which essentially means that Real Madrid get more money than they would have got because they have been the most successful team in the Champions League years. Now, if you keep doing that, you obviously increase the chances of getting this kind of competitive imbalance, because you give Juventus, you give Real Madrid, you give Barcelona, you give Bayern Munich, you give Paris Saint-Germain a lot more money, a lot more of the Champions League pie to themselves, and give them a much bigger advantage over the domestic rivals. If you look at Paris Saint-Germain's latest financial figures, they have a revenue of over 500 million. Now, most of that revenue is financial doping, artificial, from Qatar. But the problem that the French league has is their revenue is three times that of the second biggest club in France, Olympique Lyonnais. And if you have a three times revenue advantage over your biggest rival, the guys who should be pushing you for the title, then it's very hard to see this kind of early victory and almost guaranteed victories of the domestic title disappearing. You have to basically make a complete mess of your own campaign to give the competition a chance, which Bayern Munich tried to do this season, but I've still recovered at a point where, you know, you've got still a decent number of games left to play, but it looks pretty much like they're going to win the title regardless in Germany. So UEFA has a problem, and as you say, the big clubs like the idea of a Super League because they think they can make more money from having these glamour games on a more consistent basis. And there is an internal pressure within that ECA and the elite clubs in the ECA to push for a Super League. It's not, I understand, unanimous. I believe that some of the clubs do not see a Super League as the way to go. I believe Real Madrid, for example, are opposed to the idea of a Super League as it's being proposed by, in contrast, Juventus, who are very keen on that idea. But it's definitely a key matter in the economics and in the political scene in Europe. Even in the Premier League, which has thrived on having one of the most equitable distributions of broadcast revenue of all the European leagues. And therefore, I think as a result, we have this situation where you've got six clubs who have the financial wherewithal to realistically compete for the title at present. Even the Premier League has removed some of that egalitarianism with its new broadcast structure, in that previously the overseas rights were divided absolutely equally between the 20 clubs in the Premier League. The next deal coming in will see that overseas revenue, which is on course to be bigger than the domestic revenue in the next rights deal, divided according to performance in the league. So essentially Manchester United, Manchester City, Liverpool, Tottenham, Arsenal, Chelsea can expect to get more of that overseas revenue and have a bigger advantage over the teams at the bottom going forward. And I think something that hasn't really been commented on a lot is we've had this, you know, excellent title race between City and Liverpool, and we've had, you know, two teams at the top getting close to record points totals, and, you know, an argument that it's the best Premier League ever because of that. It's not really been commented that the bottom half of the division is probably the worst and least competitive it's ever been. So Huddersfield went down almost the equal earliest relegation of a team in Premier League history. And Fulham went down, I think, the week after. So you've got two of the relegation places decided with many games left to play, which is unusual. But I think indicative of the increase in difference between the bottom end of the Premier League and the top end. Which again has been masked slightly by Watford and Wolves doing well in the middle ground. But Watford and Wolves are kind of unusual clubs in the sense that one has great funding from China and a very good recruitment policy, and the other has a really good recruitment policy with the Pozzo family leveraging a scouting network that's been successful at recruiting players from all around the world for their clubs for well over a decade now. So both are really good in the transfer market, and I think that's the reason why they've been able to deliver reasonable league positions, and in Wolves' case, a lot of good results against the top six sides. But essentially, we're seeing the Premier League get more polarised as well. It's just the Premier League has an advantage in that the polarisation leaves a group of top teams who are very competitive between each other. So you get an interesting top end of the league off the back of that.
How big a factor, Duncan, is the Premier League and its financial power in disrupting the demands or the desire from someone like PSG, say, who are in the French league where they don't have that level of competition to face?
I think it's a factor because obviously the Premier League clubs are less likely to want to sacrifice the huge money that they make from their domestic competition for a European Super League. So they will want it structured in a way that they can retain Premier League representation and retain the broadcast revenue from the Premier League. But that hasn't stopped them. We've seen Der Spiegel's stories on the kind of the background discussions that these clubs have been having about Super League. It hasn't stopped them from being involved in the discussions and being positive towards the general idea. So it doesn't mean they're going to be able to. The Premier League will stop it. I think more of a factor in stopping this is something like FIFA, who are against the idea of a European Super League if they're not involved in it, and are threatening that were clubs to unilaterally set up a Super League outside UEFA's auspices, that they would remove the right of players involved in that Super League to play in the World Cup. So that's kind of the stick which FIFA, one of the governing bodies, are trying to keep a lid on this. However, were those European Super League clubs, I think, to go to FIFA and propose that the Super League was organised by them and FIFA were to have access to the revenues from it, perhaps that threat might disappear.
Okay, we're going to move on to the quickfire round now, and every Monday we have a heroes and villains section where the guys pick the person they think is most appropriate for the award from the weekend's action. So we're going to go straight away to Duncan, and you've picked out today's hero.
Yeah, I think the hero has to be the outstanding performance or match-deciding performance of the FA Cup semi-finals, and that would be Gerard Deulofeu's sub appearance from the bench for Watford when it looked like the semi-final was gone and that Wolves were going to play Manchester City at Wembley again in the final, but scored, I think, a really inspirational goal and one of the best goals I've seen in a Wembley semi-final or final for quite some time in terms of creativity and audacity to break that game open. And then went and had a beautiful, controlled, confident finish where he just managed to pass the ball in an angle past Wolves goalkeeper Ruddy to decide the match. So I think he has to be the hero of the weekend.
And Ian, who's your villain?
Well, I'm sure all Stoke fans who were laughing when Paris Saint-Germain bought their legendary midfielder Choupo-Moting will have been laughing also if they saw the footage from the weekend's game in Ligue 1 when Paris Saint-Germain had the opportunity to go 16 victories in a row at home in the league this season. But not only that, they would clinch Ligue 1 as well with 6 weeks to go. And for some reason, and please search this goal, people, Christopher Nkunku shot is going in. There is no reason for the Motingmeister to get involved, but he does. And what does he do? He jams the ball between his foot and the base of the post, leaving the ball literally on the line while he crosses the line. Now, unfortunately, he doesn't get the goal for crossing the line. Only the ball matters. So he's got to be villain for me. I think just before we go, an honourable mention to villain assisted referee at Wembley on Saturday evening, which decided that a headbutt and pulling down the face of Ali Jahangirbash by Kyle Walker was not a red card offence. Therefore, not only making a mockery of villain assisted referee, but also the laws of the game, which insist that when such an offence has been committed, it's an automatic red card.
Poor Brighton. My heart bled for you. I know they're your local club.
Yeah, you know, we put up a good performance, Johnny. But as someone who believes that second is nowhere, then, you know, I will be a little bit stretched and vetched by such situations.
The other semi-final more than made up for it, Duncan. What a game that was.
Yeah, I think they were both good games to watch, actually. I was impressed by the way Brighton tried to come back into the match and the manner in which they played the second half. And yeah, the second semi-final was a fantastic game of football. And interesting to see whether Watford can stop Manchester City winning the FA Cup and doing a double of the Cups this season. I think Wolves had the better opportunity to do that. I think they were better set up to beat Manchester City. But let's see if Javi Gracia, who's done a fantastic job at Watford, it has to be said, can come up with a plan to win the FA Cup.
And we should say as well, very quickly, Johnny, commiserations to Raul Jimenez, because his superhero mask celebration probably did deserve to win Hero of the Weekend had Jerry D knock him on and blown him out of the water with, and I agree with Duncan, one of the most superb goals I have seen. It was, you watch the way his foot digs into the turf first, so that the ball rises rapidly and curls round. It's just incredible.
Okay, well, it's time to slam this particular transfer window shut. But fear not, we will be back on Wednesday to answer your questions. To continue the debate, you can contact us on Twitter. We have our own transfer window official account at Transfer Podcast. And each of us has our accounts. You can get me at Johnny R. McFarlane, Ian at GarboSJ, and Duncan at Duncan Castles. If you like the podcast, and we know thousands of you do, please give something back by popping onto iTunes and giving us a 5-star review, as this helps us reach as many listeners as possible. Until Wednesday, thanks for listening.